You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sebastian Bremer. Sebastian, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hello.
So, Sebastian, we're talking about your show, of course, at Edwin Hook Gallery, Super Modern Things. And I love the work in the show and really looking forward to talking about it. But before we go into the medium and what's happening here in a number of ways, does this show differ in a particular way from previous work you made? Does this body of work depart in any way you want to talk about from previous work?
Yeah, I mean, every show that I've done has had a distinct kind of, you know, style or way of working. But this exhibition has a particular long leg because it goes all the way to the very beginning when I started working from New York City, which was in 1992. And I had a book that were just stunning pictures of flowers in them, and I always wanted to find a way to use them. And I started really applying paint to these particular images around 2009. And what you will see at the show now is a selection of the very newest and from the last 2-3 years, and also some works from the very beginning of this journey. And it speaks a little bit to, you know, it's kind of identity politics in a weird way, because it's tulips and I'm from Holland, but at the same time, tulips are grown traditionally in Turkey and Morocco and Syria, the very places where all the migrants from the current migration into Holland comes from, and that's politically fraught. And so it's playing with a few ideas.
I like that. Go on. And at the same time.
Well, and at the same time, I mean, isn't it? It's a bit of a commentary at the same time of market forces that are embedded in the history of tulip growing, and tulips themselves were kind of filled with bacteria and other fungi that ended up destroying the bulbs themselves, which made them not good things to trade anymore, which created the first market crash. And so it also speaks a little bit to our current mania for the new thing, all the AI investments to whatever it is. And those particular investments also have their own fungi embedded in them. So I'm interested in that, and I visualize it with my drawing. That's basically what I do.
Yeah, it's so interesting. In terms of background and context, also, you mentioned that this is drawn from a book of images, right? What images are those? Are those 19th century images or 20th century images that you saw?
The original book is a bunch of lithographs that were made during the Second World War, made as some kind of a patriotic gift, secretly made during the war and gifted to the queen right after the occupation of the Germans. But the second volume that I really fell in love with was a sales catalog from the 17th century with just depictions of all these tulips, very plain, very straightforward. They're not intended in any artistic way, but they're beautiful watercolors anyway. And they have all the values of the different plants on them. And so that I found, you know, very useful. And the last bunch is different images of more what you would say traditional flower still lifes, mostly made on very dark backgrounds and mostly by a female painter from the 17th century that has only recently been rediscovered. Her name is Rachel Rice. And so there are a lot of different sources, 3 books.
So, yeah, you know, right. There's that also, you know, there's a kind of Dutch tradition too of so many things that you said, but also of this kind of work too, you know, still lifes, this isn't quite a still life, but it is, right? These are, would you think of these more as kind of the way botanical prints, scientific, you know, drawings are done, or are we talking about still lifes here?
Yeah, I think they're almost morality pieces. Like a Vanitas painting, it shows you an image of something very seductive and very beautiful, and it's made in a certain sense really lifelike, At the same time, it's a depiction, and it is also a depiction of something that will wilt and fall apart. And so the Vanitas pictures are very much about holding a mirror up to society and say, I know you're feeling great right now, but you will wither, you know. But it's not necessarily that I'm all the time wagging my finger in that way. But these are all different thoughts that come to mind when I started working on this body of work.
And so let's jump into the body of work. How, before we talk about actual images, which I'd like to talk about, beginning with cunning stunts, how are these built? Because these are drawings on top of chromogenic prints. Could you explain that process a little bit?
Yeah, so I tend to always work with a photographic print, also just because it's like a drawing, you can roll it up. So I travel, make my studio in different places. These are photographs that I took from various sources, mostly books, and then I print them pretty much straightforward. I don't do any computer retouching or whatever. All the manipulation of the image I do with paint, ink, and pen. And so each piece is also really one of a kind. Again, playing a little bit with the medium itself, because the photography is intended normally to be printed in an edition, and my pieces are all one of a kind. So every mark is handmade. And you're not supposed to touch a photograph normally as well, and I do it all over the place. And then the inks I use, sometimes they're alcohol-based inks, so they really create these luminous explosions. Then I have photo dyes that really sink into the sea print emulsion. Then I use acrylic paints that really lay on top of the emulsion and sometimes are really almost, you know, a few inches, how do you call it, millimeters lifted from the surface itself. So when you see the real piece in itself, it's really material. The photograph of my work tends to be very reductive. You really have to see the thing almost as a sculptural piece. There's also sometimes little holes in it. You know, it's a real three-dimensional experience that I, kind of an illusion that I like to pull people into. And then cunning stunts is relatively recent. It's also a bit of wordplay in there, and that I lifted myself again from Vladimir Nabokov, who likes wordplay a lot.
How does it come from Vladimir Nabokov? What's the relation there?
From his books. I mean, I started working from more remote location about 3 years ago. And so I've been rediscovering language, first the Dutch one, which I had not really used as much for the last 20, 30 years. And but the most beautiful writer I find is Nabokov. So I'm making my way through his entire oeuvre, and there's a lot of it, and his layering technique of language is very seductive, and I find a lot of joy in reading it, and also I kind of hope to mirror myself a little bit with his way of writing. People really talk always about Lolita. I actually only read that when I was a kid, and I will do that at the end of my complete dig through all his work, but that's where I'm stealing my titles from at the moment.
That's so interesting, right? So that these are, you know, I guess you can't say these are research-based, but these are literary works in some sense, right? I mean, you talked about books from beginning visually, but now you're talking about specific content and a kind of love for Nabokov, right? A kind of love for that literature, that particular writer, that craft even.
Yeah, I have always been a bibliophile. Like, I worked as a kid in a comic book store that started about when I was 12, and that really shaped my practice and my education in a sense, and I'm mostly self-taught, and so I just, like a Hoover, suck everything up. And in the beginning of my life, it was a lot of comic books and the books that I found in my parents' library, and I was reading a lot of books that were maybe not yet age appropriate. And I grab things from everywhere, but I love books and I love drawings also because they're not so bulky. You can roll them up or take them in and put them in your pocket. And I mean, like Duchamp has a nice habit of that, doing it as well, like wrapping things up and putting it in a suitcase and taking it with you. And I like art not to take up too much space. And when I stopped really making paintings that you have to store somewhere, I found a huge amount of relief. And it's the same with images, that I really enjoy recycling images. It could be old photographs that I've taken, or old family pictures, or things from books even, because it feels like it's just a cleaning operation, you know? It's like, who needs more images? We have plenty. They're being generated by the billions today on our phones. But I think there's enough already that's really good.
So when you
add something to it.
Right. And when you talk about traveling with this work, rolling it up and being in different places, it sounds like you're not typically working out of a studio. You're on the road for many of these?
Yeah, I did have a for many years, many studio settings that I really enjoyed. But at some point, my last, most recent big studio in Greenpoint got gentrified. And I just started realizing I'm not so sure if I really need this anymore to the same extent. And when I started making my art, I was always employed as a producer for these photographers, Inez and Finut. And there was an enormous amount of waiting involved, and just sitting in the studio while people are doing hair and makeup takes for fucking ever. So I preferred just to do something instead of pretend reading a really thick book. So that's how I started making these very incremental drawings. And then later in life, when my ex-wife and me would travel a lot because she's a choreographer, I would take care of my little son. And in the downtime, I wanted to work. So we would be in, say, Copenhagen. And on the kitchen table, I would roll out the piece and would work on there. And then when the kid wakes up, you roll it up again and put it away. And that has continued to be my preferred way of working. It's working with limitations is very useful, I find.
So you don't need a traditional studio. You have the prints made at a lab, I imagine, and then you're working on a cool work anywhere, on a table, in a hotel.
Basically, I mean, I really prefer, of course, to have a nice studio and to hang it up and really being able to take a big look from a distance. But it's not always so easy to find that. And like I said, I like working with the limitation. It's I think also ingrained, because since I started out making drawings quite young, sitting at a table and drawing, or at least standing over a table hunched, is my physical, most logical way of making art. Like when I painted and I would stand in front of a painting, like, you know, Willem de Kooning with a brush in my hand, I always felt like I was faking it a little bit. And then paint drips down and stuff like that. When you do it vertically onto a horizontal picture, you can do different things.
Yeah, that's so true. However, humanity is another work here that's quite different from cunning stunts, right? The imagery is different. How you're using color is quite different. Let's talk about that one a little bit, because that seems very very unusual in a number of ways.
Yeah, that work is made from one of those images from the 17th century tulip catalog. And so some of the longhand writing you can see on the bottom of the piece in brown ink is from that period, title of the original name of the flower and other things. And because there's a lot of white there, although there are some, you know, stains and stuff like that, I had an empty canvas to paint on and lots of white. And these flowers I really turn into almost like mannequins, like how a mannequin is completely dressed and naked and just made out of white plastic. This becomes like a clothes hanger or something to drape things over. And so this painting is it's a bit of a whirlwind of mark making all over the place. And it is a bit of a play on words again by Nabokov, but so you know, there's a lot of life happening there. It's a very chaotic. It's but then it's, you know, this tragic end of a sentence. However, humanity, and then, you know. Mm. whatever you want to take it, wherever you want to take it there. It's not like it, everything is so heavy with commentary, but daily life doesn't pass unnoticed, and everything worms its way into the pictures that I make.
Well, yeah, as you said at the beginning, in terms of references, I mean, we're living in a pretty volatile moment. So these aren't specifically political works. You're saying that's all finding its way in there somehow.
Oh yeah. Well, I think there's everything is political at this moment and has always been, but this is you could say that they're like morality plays. But through a certain cultural lens, and that happens to be mine, and that's, you know, I'm a migrant to the United States. I'm a Dutch person. I read books. I was born in 1970. There's a lot of things that have definitely shaped me, and I really am a student of history, I guess, and just. This is just crazy amount of things that influence our current times. We are not living in a vacuum, and I find particularly, you know, I try to have it do it with a sense of humor, but we I think in the United States particularly we have a particular relationship with history. It is almost like as if how do you call it? This singularity of the United States, and it is not really. There's many historical references that you could apply to the United States, and I find that fascinating and resonant. And at the same time, I'm not anything more than a picture maker, and so that's what I do.
Well, also a sense of humor is something that we typically don't have so much in the United States. So that's how I see it now. In the art world, I don't usually talk about a sense of humor with artists, and I've interviewed a lot, right? Sense of humor is
rare. I think, well, it's hard to apply in art, I think. Same like beauty is also has so many. There's so many prejudices against, like, as if beauty is shallow by definition, and you could say the same thing about things that are tickling you or are funny. But I severely disagree, and I think that, for instance, Nabokov is extremely funny, and he's filled with little puns and little things, and you should be tickled. The same I find in music that I find appealing. There can be a lot of echoes and little things back and forth. I mean, jazz is all full of that. It's there's so many puns, little echoes. If you pay good attention, well, you know, if you pay attention, you can see a lot of things. And it doesn't make you necessarily smarter or more profound to see everything in a very dark way. It feels then you're kind of stuck because there's no out. And I think if you find a way to get tickled, you start to giggle, and then, you know, that's a good one against the man, I would say.
I like that. Yeah, I agree. It's one of the best pushbacks possible, I think, against the man, so to speak. One Foot Resting on the Ground is one other work that I wanted to talk about. This again has a different palette and also a different approach, as opposed to However Humanity and Cunning Stunts. One Foot Resting on the Ground seems to have kind of worlds within worlds. There's that layering effect, that sense of depth, but it also looks like there's much more in here than going after this image of a flower. It almost feels like I'll start seeing another world within there, if that makes sense. The line work around the flower and dripping down just has a sense of energy. I'm not saying it's better than the others, but it's very different than Cunning Stunts and However Humanity. It feels more like there's something else happening in there, that there's almost something emitting from there.
Yeah, well, I think it partly has to do, of course, with the underlying image. It's a very flat, almost scientific rendering of that flower. You know, you can see every little bit. It's super, super flat. It's also, you know, there's many differences to each piece, like size-wise, for instance. This is also a much smaller piece. But you feel that it has a different spatial quality?
Yeah, I think a different spatial quality, a different the line quality is definitely something different, right? There's all these lines coming out. I mean, there's some of that in However Humanity, a little bit in Cunning Stunts, but this one feels like there's many kind of lines descending, almost like a kind of calligraphy. There seems to be almost something else happening there with this. Where it almost looks like a purple figure. You know.
It is. Yeah, I mean the touch is quite light with this one. It's almost a little bit like there's seismographic touches. So I don't know if you've ever seen, but there are some imagery of how, for instance, how do you call them? Little elements from space make themselves shoot through us all the time, right? And there's renderings of that. I forget what it's called, but it's basically this bombardment of other things that we undergo all the time. And with this image, it seems almost to me that I've kind of, I set out to make a rendering of something that actually occurs with a living object continuously, but is not seen to the naked eye. So these are almost minute little movements or bacteria or little elements zooming and grabbing little things, and they have their own particular logic and their own particular reality that we're not aware of, but completely part of. A little bit like gut bacteria or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
But
that's how it feels.
Yeah, I mean, these things also very much grow organically. So it is, like I say, keep on saying with puns, they are... you know, I do one thing which leads to another. It's very traditional painting, really. You know, when people talk about abstract paintings and then they do a little touch of red there and that requires a little yellow on the left corner and that in turn, you know, so that is also how these pieces come together. And and this one particularly, it has a really nice rhythm to it, I find. When I look at it now, I'm looking at the pictures as you're talking about them because I don't always know exactly which is which. But One Foot and I love the title too because, again, there's the piece is cut, right? Like there's the flower and then there's the stem and then there's the leaves and the bottom of the stem on the side of it. So actually, this is a completely dead flower. It's completely removed from the ground. But the way that it's like living here, it seems very connected and quite alive, but technically not possible. So it has one foot still resting on the ground, a little bit like a soldier who was running through a field and then one leg is blown off and he keeps on hopping like a Monty Python soldier or... Well, there's a lot of images like that.
Well, a little bit like one foot in the grave, the phrase one foot in the grave.
Yeah, or hopping, it basically is one foot in the grave, yeah.
And I like that. It's been great talking to you about this. I want to ask you one more question, but of course for listeners, hope you can go see the show at Edwin Hook. There's more information in here and links to follow to visit the show. I want to ask you one more question, a little off topic. What are you reading at the moment? Nabokov, I imagine.
Yeah, disappointingly so. The Gift, but I just started, so I don't have a lot of smart things to say about it. But on the way over to my most recent destination, I was reading his book called Think, Write, Speak, and it's highly recommended. It is all short writings and speeches that he did, and it's amazing.
Thanks so much. Sebastian, I want to thank you for your time talking with me today and also for, of course, putting together this gorgeous show. Listeners, again, have links to follow to go see the show if you can. Thanks again, Sebastian, for talking with me today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.